Good evening, Los Angeles, and welcome to K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show with me, Steve Cato, and my brilliant co-host, Nicholas Miller.
Hey, Steve.
Hey, wow.
Wow. Did you guys hear that good from Steve leading in? I don't know who replaced Vin Scully up the street, but they should have tapped Steve.
Boy, you know, every time the Dodgers are playing, it just warms my heart just a little bit more, doesn't it? I just love our boys in blue. The boys of somewhere back. That's right. And that what that means is it's so annoying to use Chinatown this time of year.
It's awful. But luckily, the Dodgers only play like 187 games or something.
It's just so relaxing.
Yeah.
Yeah. To be fair, I think that does make up for the fact that baseball seems like a brutally unstrenuous and unserious sport.
Didn't they just recently this year make it more strenuous and more serious?
I don't know. Did they?
Yeah, they changed all the rules.
So what? You have to do push-ups or something like that? You have to run the whole time?
I think it's just a lot faster. It's supposed to be a lot faster.
Good.
Which had a negative result for me the other day because I oftentimes play soccer in Solano Canyon.
I've heard of it.
Which is right next to the Dodger Stadium.
Yes.
And we play at 7 and they start at 7 and we end at 9 and they usually end at some preposterous hour.
Yeah, like 11:30 or something.
But this Monday, we started at the same time. We ended at the same time.
Ah!
Because of these new rules.
Wow, so the games are actually that much shorter.
I don't know, but I don't know a lot about baseball. I know that sometimes you can go into extra innings and that extends the whole thing.
That's my understanding.
I think that happens even in the regular season, unlike other sports.
That happens in most sports if you are tied or something.
No, in the regular season, you just tie, I think.
Really?
In soccer, you do.
Don't you, like, go to kicks?
In basketball,
something?
You do.
That's just for the... I guess just I only watch...
playoffs.
I only watch, like, sort of tournament soccer, I guess. That's why I think that soccer just works that way.
No, it definitely doesn't. I think most sports, other than baseball, they have to find a winner. So maybe just most games that go into overtime or whatever, extra innings. I have no idea. But either way, I read about these rules.
Yeah, and they said faster.
They said faster. That was the goal.
Yeah.
And then sure enough, I have
faster
some anecdotal evidence. I didn't go to a baseball game.
Well, you were. You know what? You did everything but go to the baseball game, really.
That's true. Sometimes when, you know, like we're doing our adult recreation there on the soccer field, like someone will score a goal and it'll coincide with an enormous event at Dodger Stadium.
Oh, cool.
That feels kind of good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You're like,
60,000 people about, you know, like a quarter of a mile away. Yell.
And you're like, that's right. That was another Nicholas Miller special.
Yeah. I just crossed the ball over that other 38-year-old guy.
That I can see that feeling pretty good.
Yeah.
God, I just love the Dodgers so much. I don't.
Yeah.
Love experimental music. I like talking. I like conceptual art. I don't like most team sports, although I don't have strong feelings against them either. Welcome to the Talking Show.
Yes, the Talking Show.
And we got a long one tonight, so I'll tell you what. You know who is a fan of baseball?
Who's that?
Our guest.
Oh, that's true.
Meaningfully, and without any hint of irony, throughout the opening pitch of her beloved Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
One year.
I gotta say, it's a little charming to me when somebody who's kind of really invested in some obscure aspect of culture has a straightforward relationship to like.
The rest of culture, actually.
Yeah, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
It's oftentimes sports. You know, you'll encounter people in the art world, you know, strange artists, and they're like, they just love the Dodgers, or they love the basketball team, or hockey,
totally.
Or something. And it's kind of charming.
I feel like it's a good compensatory measure
to keep
you from being a full alien.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
Where you're like, because otherwise, like, you really do share nothing with people.
It's true.
I had to take a Lyft over here, and my Lyft driver today... we talked about the transmissions of various cars and I was like a little out of my depth, but I was like, you know, I can, this I have at least like some moderate amounts of knowledge about, you know, like a Tesla doesn't have a transmission. Not really.
Transmission switches gears.
Yeah.
And that motor is not geared.
I believe it's just like a direct torque. That's why it's so zippy.
Oh, okay.
It's like this much electricity, this much voltage means this much spin, this fast go.
Huh.
Yeah. So there's no like
Clever spinning girl.
Up to the... Jurassic Park. But yeah, you know, there's no spinning up kind of thing with that. It just goes straight. You know, so it's like there are things I know about the drivetrains of Priuses.
Mm-hmm.
The dude picked me up in a new Prius, like a brand new Prius, which actually okay. looks not half bad. I think the problem with Priuses has been that A, they feel sluggish to drive, and B, they look kind of shitty.
Yeah.
But
sometimes, like, there was a couple years there where it got into, like, bad, like, good shitty. Like, you're like, oh, that looks like a... Jeez.
Ladies and gentlemen, yeah. A second Dodgers has just hit Dodger Stadium.
Yeah, the owner of the Dodgers is leaving the game.
Oh,
but, gosh, wow, the Dodgers just fogging my mind in all kinds of ways. There was like a good shitty Prius years there where it looked like a messed up Lego toy or something.
Yeah, those were the first couple years of Prius yeah. where it looked like a Yaris.
One of our neighbors just got an Ioniq.
Oh, like a Hyundai?
Yeah, but
Ioniq.
There's a couple of them.
The name reminds me of like a skincare kind of thing. Like, don't you feel like it's like a you know, like a Estee Lauder Ioniq?
Yeah,
or
it's
something.
Like a yeah, an Estee Lauder air purifier.
Yeah.
But there's a couple of different ones I've seen, but this one is a sedan, and the back of it is beautiful.
Oh, it's like Pixels, kind of.
No, it's kind of just tapers nicely. Kind of looks like a 50s car. It's really, you know, because, you know, there are fewer design constraints because the engine works very differently. So
yeah.
You can have some more fun, but that's not how the general market
the
works.
The Ioniq crossover has like a pixelated back, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, I think this one might have that too, but that's not the most important feature to me.
Okay. Not the most important
I hate pixelation.
Feature, not the most important feature
I hate
to him,
it.
Folks.
I hate pixelation.
Does renders for a living. Hates
yeah.
pixels.
Yeah. 8K or bust.
Well, one thing that is also not an 8K is the audio of our guests talking. We have a historical recording all the way from the hallowed, I don't know, what is it called? Like the 197th Street Y or whatever.
I think 98th.
Yeah. Too many streets. Which, that's what I say.
But that doesn't, you know, so I've heard many recorded talks from this particular YMCA.
Uh-huh.
I think it's a YMCA, not a WCA.
I don't know.
It's just a Y. I don't know.
Yeah.
They rebranded, right? But what always puzzled me is like, that leads me to believe that there are at least 98 of these in New York or something, or maybe. Maybe there's not one on every cross street, but is this the only one that does anything like this?
I think so.
Okay.
I only have one on every cross street. I mean, when I was a Y member and you got reciprocal access, I would go to the Y and when in New York. And
I see.
You really had to track one down.
Okay.
But I believe that this one has also separated itself from the actual YMCA proper organization. It's like its own thing.
It's like when an art space opens and names itself after the preceding business.
I think it was a gradual absorption of this like YMCA with a more ambitious than average cultural program that where the cultural program just absorbed the rest of the Y.
Gotcha.
Although, you know, I've never been in person, so I don't know. Maybe like you turn from the poetry reading, the new music concert, you turn your head and there's just like an older gentleman doing some sort of early 20th century style calisthenic.
Oh.
Motion. 'Cause that's the thing about the Y, right? Is it like, sure, there are like some gym bros there, but like usually gym bros go somewhere else. And what you get at the Y is like an aging university professor doing an exercise from like the middle of the 20th century.
Sure.
Like some yeah. sort of weird, twist bend thing that has not been recuperated.
Right.
With like a kettlebell, but it's not like been recuperated into right. CrossFit. Like it doesn't look badass. It just looks like
yeah.
weird.
This was a wonderfully developed exercise during the early Hitler Youth period.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know,
exactly.
the later project that was known as the Hitler Youth Project really crushed any real studies of the early exercises.
I mean, I feel like that it is refreshing to look at the history of calisthenics and see that it's always been goofy, but it's also like so susceptible to fads.
It's true. Yeah.
Like the kind of thing where if it looks silly to you now, it's probably going to look silly in the future. But people just do what they know, you know. I think going to undergrad in the 90s, there were definitely still people at the like university gym I would go to, which was in like a castle in Toronto, who had like learned calisthenics in the 30s. Like some few of them still survived.
Sure.
And yeah, had been part of some sort of like Steiner School,
mm-hmm.
Maria Montessori, fascist adjacent.
Yeah. Life is an artwork.
Like nudist European thing. And then yeah. Now they were like a teacher of, you know, dead languages or something like that. You know, like
sure.
now they were like a aging German tenured Sanskrit scholar or something like that. With like long fingernails, wearing like
right.
sweat stained,
rather hirsute.
Yeah. Knee brace on every knee.
even yeah, neck brace, all the
neck brace, fully braced, sweaty wife beater, doing some very weird physical culture shit. You know, one thing about our guest's pitch, opening pitch, is I don't know how fast it was. Like as a fan, did our guest have like the calisthenic backbone to support such a pitch? Did it cross the plate? How did things go? I wonder.
Always asking the tough questions, Steve.
Well, on the topic of baseball, ladies and gentlemen, Marianne Moore.
Friends, I thank you for allowing me to feel that you weren't dragooned or coerced in coming here tonight. I wish the wise of discourse would follow these handsome and trustful words of Mr. Brennan's. I am to read from my own words and a few of my translations of the La Fontaine fables and something else if we have time. Town like this, with 8 stranded whales to look at, with the sweet sea air coming into your house on a fine day, from water etched with waves as formal as the scales on a fish. One by one, in twos, in threes, the seagulls keep flying back and forth over the town clock, or sailing round the lighthouse without moving their wings, rising steadily with a slight quiver of the body, or flop mewing where a sea of the purple of the peacock's neck is paled to greenish azure, as Dürer changed the fine green of the turtle to peacock blue and guinea gray. I'm thinking of a little watercolor by Dürer that I saw in the Ashmolean Museum. A steeplejack in red has let a rope down as a spider spins a thread. He might be part of a novel, but on the sidewalk, the sign says, C.J. Poole, steeplejack, in black and white, and then in red and white says, danger. The church has 4 fluted columns, each a single piece of stone, made modester by whitewash. This would be a fit haven for waifs, children, animals, prisoners, and presidents who have repaid sin-driven senators by not thinking about them. That wasn't written for this year. A little too appropriate. One sees a schoolhouse, a post office, in a store, fish houses, hen houses, a 3-masted schooner on the stocks. The hero, the student, the steeplejack, each in his way, is at home. It scarcely could town like this of simple people who have a steeplejack placing danger signs by the church when he is guilty, the solid pointed star, which on a steeple stands for hope. Now, bowls, bowling. In Vancouver, there is bowling on the green with lignum-bodied balls and ivory markers, with pins planted in wild duck formation and quickly dispersed. We are precisionists. Not if anybody has a copy of my book in which it says we are precisions, that was a little contradiction of the fact. I let it go through edition after edition of the book and didn't see the misprint. We are precisionists, not citizens of Pompeii arrested in action, as a cross-section of one's correspondence would seem to imply. Renouncing a policy of boorish indifference to everything that has been said since the days of Matilda, I shall purchase an etymological dictionary that I may understand what is written, and like the ant and the spider, returning from time to time to headquarters, shall answer the question, why do I like winter better than I like summer? And acknowledge that it does not make me sick to look playwrights and poets and novelists straight in the face. I feel just the same. And I shall write to the publisher of the magazine, which will appear the first day of the month and disappear before one has time to buy it, unless one takes proper precaution, and make an effort to please, since he who gives quickly gives twice, in nothing so much as in a letter. I might say that I do not like winter better than I like summer. I think I was quoting from someone else. Now, selections from the Gerboa. In preparing for this program, I became quite adept in omitting my own work. I found that some of it reads better than other parts of it, so I'll spare you the more difficult portions. Now, in the Gerboa, I say something about Roman artistry and Roman craftsmen. And then, others could build and understood making colossi and how to use slaves and kept crocodiles and put baboons on the necks of giraffes to pick fruit and use serpent magic. They had men tie hippopotami and bring out dappled dog cats to hunt antelopes, dik-dik, and ibex, or use small eagles. They looked on as theirs, impalas and onagers, the wild ostrich herd with hard feet and bird necks moving back in the dust like a serpent preparing to strike. And they had cranes, mongooses, storks, anolas, Nile geese, and there were gardens for these, with square pools of pink flowers, tame fish, and small frogs. Let me interrupt myself, lest I forget. There's another misprint I discovered today. Dappled dog cats. There should be a D. Dappled dog cats. That's on page 17, if anybody cares. Now, I omit a portion. Pharaoh's rat. I've always been fascinated with mongooses, and I had a time keeping the mongoose out of this, in order to proceed with the Gerboa. Pharaoh's rat, the rust-backed mongoose, was praised for its wit, and the Gerboa, like it, a small desert rat and not famous, that lives without water, has happiness. Abroad seeking food or at home in its burrow, the Sahara field mouse has a shining silver house of sand. Oh, rest and joy the boundless sand, the stupendous sand spot. No water, no palm trees, no ivory bed, tiny cactus. But one would not be he who has nothing but plenty. Hump the Gerboa you will be cursed. It honors the sand by assuming its color. Closed upper paws, seeming one with the fur in its flight from the danger. Its leaps should be set to the flagellate. Pillar body erect on a three-cornered, smooth-working chippendale paw, propped on hind legs and tail as third toe between leaps to its burrow. Now, what are years? Our innocence. What is our guilt? All are naked, none is safe. And whence is courage? The unanswered question, the resolute doubt. Dumbly calling, deftly listening, that in misfortune even death encourages others, and in its defeat stirs the soul to be strong. He sees deep and is glad, accedes to mortality, and in his imprisonment rises upon himself as a sea in a chasm, struggling to be free and unable to be, in its surrendering finds its continuum. So he who strongly feels behaves. The very bird, grown taller as he sings, steals his form straight up. Though he is captive, his mighty singing says, satisfaction. How pure a thing is joy. This is mortality. This is eternity. Now, the icosasphere. Set out to write a thing, and I said, talk like this? Oh no, he said, there's something, a piece of poetry. Well, I'm not, that's his term, not mine. But I never do really consciously undertake something. I am captured by it, and then I go on from one point to another. I'm very susceptible to interest in mechanical ingenuity, like zippers and escalators and expansible watch braces and a collapsible dustpan. And then, of course, the photoelectric cell mechanism in the Pennsylvania station that opens the door before you get there. I always read Waldemar Kempfert's science column in the Times, and I happened there on a description of this steel sphere, the icosasphere. And it said that Mr. Jackson, J.O. Jackson of the Mellon Laboratories, worked out a design whereby 20 equilateral triangles could be grouped into 5 parallelograms and cut rectangular sheet of steel with almost no loss, scrap loss of steel. Well, that seemed most auspicious to me. So, it's this. In Buckinghamshire hedgerows, the birds nesting in green density weave little bits of string and moss and feathers and thistledown in parabolic concentric curves. Working for concavity, leave spherical feats of rare efficiency. Then there is the icosasphere, in which we have at last steel cutting at its summit of economy, since 20 triangles conjoined can wrap one ball or double rounded shell with almost no waste, so geometrically neat, it's an icosahedron. Would the engineers making one, or Mr. J.O. Jackson, tell us how the Egyptians could have set up 78-foot solid granite vertically. We should like to know how that was done. Now you may marvel to hear that that is rhyme. was how the Egyptians would set up those solid columns of granite at Karnak. And soon after my collected poems appeared, I had a letter from a Mrs. Heimbach saying that Dr. Stichini, S-T-I-C-C-H-I-N-I, of Princeton, has in preparation a book which might answer the question. He has discovered that the Egyptians had an abacus based on the logarithmic principles, like our modern slide rule, and they also had a measure which was capable of refinements greater than a hundredth of an inch. Well, Mrs. Heimbach says that the Egyptians are said to have built the pyramids with the aid of these expedients. And Dr. Stichini, she says, which I can well believe, is a phenomenalist. He's a phenomenalist. And an authority, besides, on early Greek and Roman law. Now, perhaps his book has already appeared. I've been interested in other things since then, but now, three more of my own. Nevertheless, nevertheless, you've seen a strawberry that's had a struggle. Yet walls where the fragments met, a hedgehog or a starfish for the multitude of seeds. What better food than apples? Where there was a prickly pear leaf clinging to barbed wire, a root shot down to grow in earth 2 feet below. Victory won't come to me unless I go to it. A grape tendril ties a knot in knots till knotted 30 times, so the bound twig that's overgone and undergone can't stir. The weak overcomes its menace, the strong overcomes itself. What is there like fortitude? What sap went through the little thread to make the cherry red? Thank you. Now, this is another scientific laboratories. I asked me to write something about medicine for their magazine, What's New? So I've always been interested in medicine, so I said I would. Something about the Caduceus. And they very politely accepted the piece and then paid me for it. And then they said, well, the Caduceus could refer to more than medicine. Didn't I mean the staff of Aesculapius? Well, this whole thing is really a collaboration with the laboratories and its research staff and some medical students of medicine that they consulted. In this, I mentioned the Salk, Dr. Jones Salk's vaccine. And as you know, he and his associates typed 74 strains of poliomyelitis virus. And Dr. Salk said, when you try 30 variables and dozens of concentrations and temperatures, you're sure to hit on the right one. Well, then, he also said that a killed vaccine, although it may give only temporary immunity for a year, has if it can do that, whereas a live vaccine might give lifelong immunity, even so, ground has been gained for another attempt. check. Then I mentioned the Sloan Kettering Institute, the recent report in which they say that we've achieved selective injury to cancer cells without injury to normal cells. This is indeed a victory, a prototype, as it were, of the tuberculosis procedure. And then I mentioned Abbott's invention, their Evolon plastic sponge for surgical implants. Maybe I've said enough, but when tissue is removed, the surgeon can cut the sponge, fit sponge into a mold identical with the cavity, put the sponge in after saturating it in some kind of antiseptic solution, and the sponge attracts fluid, or I can't think of the word, and cells come in along with the fluid and adhere to the sponge, and what was inert becomes living. That was framework. That's stated in the brochure. In fact, this wording all through is somebody else's eyes. But now, a symbol from the first of mastery, experiments such as Hippocrates made and substituted for vague speculation, stayed the ravages of a plague. A going on, yes, anastasis is the word for the virologist with variables still untried, too impassioned to desist. Suppose that research has hit on the right one and a killed vaccine is effective, say temporarily, for even a year, although a live one could give lifelong immunity. Knowledge has been gained for another attack. Selective injury to cancer cells without injury to normal ones, another gain looks like prophecy come true. Now, after lung resection, the surgeon fills space, the sponge implanted, cells following fluid adhere, and what was inert becomes living that was framework. Is it not like the master physician's Sumerian rod, staff and effigy of the animal, which by shedding its skin is a sign of renewal, the symbol of medicine? Anastasis there is the Greek, of course, in our New Testament, which is translated resurrection. Whereas it really means a going on, and I think a very encouraging thought. Now, one more of my own. A face. I am not treacherous, callous, jealous, superstitious, supercilious, venomous, or absolutely hideous. Studying its expression, though at no real impasse, exasperated desperation, would gladly break the glass. When love of order, ardor, uncircuitous simplicity are all one needs to be. Certain faces, a few, one or two, or one face, photographed by recollection, to my mind, to my sight, must remain a delight. Seemed incredible to me study so much as he must have to produce the many fables that we have in his 12 books. And Mr. Wadsworth, Professor Philip Wadsworth of Northwestern University says that he had a large collection of stories, Greek and Latin, by Nevele. Nevele's Mythologica Aesopica, N-E-V-E-L-E-T. A collection of Greek and Latin stories, very brief, no description, no dialogue, but they're always accompanied by a moral. Now let me read The Fox and the Grapes. This is Aesop. My friends will be tired of this. It seems as if it's the only illustration of what I've been doing all these years that I have. But it's been suggested that I read this as typical of the method I've been trying to use. I cluster together feint, descent, and tint. It seems to me that one should try to approximate the rhythmic skeleton or structure of the French from which one is translating, although great deal is said to the contrary, that it is dowdy to copy it exactly and so on. I can't see, no matter what is said, it seems to me that one should follow the rhythmic contour of the original, if possible. A fox of Gascon, though some say Norman descent, when starved till faint, gazed up at a trellis to which grapes were tied, mature till they glowed to it with a purplish tint, as though there were gems inside. Now, grapes were what our adventurer on straying haunches chanced to crave. But since he could not reach the vine, he said, "These grapes are sour. I'll leave for some knave. Better, I think, than an embittered wine." Thank you. Now, I'm asked, how did you come to undertake such a task, a hard task like this? I did not undertake it. I was tempted into it against my judgment by the marvelous harmonies and the symmetry of the verse. Justin O'Brien says of translating the journals of André Gide, that he was shocked that he should be asked to do it and shocked by the enormity of the task. And that is how I felt about the La Fontaine. Mr. O'Brien says one should not translate anything one does not admire. And there I am faultless, although I like some of the fables better than others. One thing I do not do, I do not extort approbation for these fables of mine, particularly not from readers who are French, and I indeed owe a great deal to the liberality of certain French readers who are specialists in language. Samuel Terrien, T-E-R-R-I-E-N, of Union Seminary, is a professor of biblical history, and his specialty is Isaiah. And he said, in connection with La Fontaine, he said, we need love for the truthful word, for the divinely expressed word. Now, this is something La Fontaine said many times, in other words, of Aesop and Phaedrus and Malherbe and poetry in general. Professor Terrien said another thing I like. The French language is accentual horizontally. But do not think of that, he said. Do not let that happen. We were speaking of the accents. and how they're distributed. Now, some linguists are not so liberal about their native language as he, and some Americans are not so liberal about what is not their native language. As I said to Mr. Brennan, I've been attacked as an upstart. Well, Hugh Kenner says we should look for major, for overall merit. And he is by no means a stingy critic. I realize that over-modesty is a mistake. I've been saying that I don't know French and I don't know literature and so on. Well, I would never think of saying that I'm a specialist in language. I will say that I have a passion for languages, and the 17th century is my favorite century. I've always been devoted to Molière, and was much pleased that, and am much pleased that he and La Fontaine were close friends. I said here last year, I think, that La Fontaine alone represents independent poetry in his time. And he had at command a wider range of tones and harmonies than any other poet of his age. And the rhymes are interposed so naturally, it's hard to believe that the conscious technique played a part in the result. As in La Joconde, one of the stories, he has Fi and Di and Aussi all close together. The story said, did not say what the man did or what he said. Ne se qu'il fit, ne se qu'il dit, and I am silent, Aussi, La Fontaine said. Well, whether it's creditable to me or not, it was this hyper-virtuosity of the ear in the French that induced me to undertake translating lines, and I might be crushed by a blow. Don't feel that you should not go. Since iron is accustomed to strain, no reason why you should remain. Then the other turned arguer and said, as for shocks you'd incur, or aught that you saw to fear, if you felt that you'd come too near, I'd expose myself instead, and you'd not be buffeted. The clay pot was satisfied, and so they fared forth side by side. The iron and the clay were protected, each on three legs as pots are constructed. Clicker, clack, click. They tried their luck, and then at each jolt, conflicted if even pebbles were struck. The clay pot suffered, in less than 50 paces, the worst the iron pot in fragments so minute you could not count them all, and with only himself to blame. Take as an equal a person who is not, and your fate may be the same as that of the earthen pot. Style means that the author has fused his material and his technique with the distinctive quality of his personality. This was in the Sarah Owen Jewett study. Shall I say that again? Style means that the author has fused his material and his technique with the distinctive quality of his personality. That perfectly described La Fontaine, it seems to me. And so does a statement by Pierre Emmanuel in an article he has just written about La Fontaine for the News Digest, Page de France. He says, La Fontaine's style is a continual creating of style, a sparkling fountain, as H.D. says, the Pierian spring, the fountain that is La Fontaine, consciously or not. This is the conclusion of it. Exterior diversity can never charm as the mind can to infinity. The spark, that sparkling fount by which enchanting gems are spilt, we promptly yawn by any ostentatious dunce. All lords in leopard's pelts, on which their fame is built, flaunt garb for gifts worth but a glance. Now, if anyone is wearing leopard fur, they're not to feel deplored, because I never see enough of it. The fables are metrically complex, Monsieur Emmanuel says. Yes, as a flower is complex. But in that complexity, we have the paradoxical simplicity of life itself. We have in La Fontaine a use of words that everyone seems to feel is the perfection of speech, le dire, D-I-R-E. Something fresh and clear that sets him apart from everyone else. Now, it's interesting indeed that in the matter of innovation, La Fontaine is special and individual in being conventional, and also he's spectacularly unconventional when he chooses to be. In The Cat and the Mouse, he stands and follows stanza, each is identical with the one before. Burgundy had requested this, a fable to be called The Cat and the Mouse. Desiring to show a young prince her esteem, and bow here literarily, fame asks that cat and mouse be my theme. Cat and mouse, let me see. Ought I to portray someone beautiful and charming, but so sportive and unmerciful that she tortures the person in captivity, as cats tease mice they will not free? Or should I take as my theme the whims of fate, nothing more to the point than demonstrate how smiling fortune treats folk contradictorily, as cats treat mice they will not free? Or should some king, a great one, be my simile, at whose word even fortune's wheel stands still, undeterred by all sorts of hostility, make sport of the mightiest, if you will, as cats toss mice they will not free. But the windings of my thought have imperceptibly brought me out where each step I take will be a loss if I let myself drone on suicidally and make my muse a mouse for the young prince to toss, like one the cat pretends to free. Those refrains are all the same. Beginning as cats, as cats, as cats, except the last one, like one that the cat pretends to free. And I must confess, it's a folly to try to mechanically follow the pattern in every detail. Now, the farmer and the adder. Here, we have no stanza, but an indivisible, varied pattern of long and short lines, four long, four short to begin with, and two long, and one short and two long. Aesop, the farmer and the adder, great discussions when I was doing these fables about the serpents in them, which were man and the serpent. The serpent friend and the harmless one, but I was permitted to call this one an adder because it was venomous. Aesop tells how a countryman, as imprudent as he was benevolent, had an estate he'd gone out to scan on a winter day and observed as he went a snake on the snow in a plight that was serious, mummied from head to tail, so no longer venomous. He dared not delay, it would die left there. So the man picked it up, took it home, gave it care, and failed to foresee the result of an action in which compassion had been complete, stirred circulation by friction and laid the maimed form near heat, which no sooner had tempered the torpid blood than anima stirred and grew livelier. The adder hissed, raised its head as best it could, coiled, and made a long lunge toward where the farmer stood. Its foster father, who had been its rescuer. The farmer said, "Ingrate, you'd be my murderer, you shall die." He picked up his axe. Pardon me, the farmer said, "Ingrate, you'd be my murderer, you shall die." He picked up his axe and the dastard was dead. Two strokes made three snakes of the coil, a body, a tail, and a head. The pestilent thirds writhed together to rear, but of course could no longer adhere. All should practice charity toward all. I've thrown some light on this. Ingrates, I say with emphasis, will always die in misery. Well, I was paid a very great compliment. It seemed to me when someone said recently that she had never objected to mice, was not afraid of them, but didn't like rats. And she said, "I've always disliked them, and you make me see how one could like them." Well, very gratified. Well, now, I was implored not to rush home after reading 20 minutes. It seems that I'm so considerate of the captive audience that I always end too soon. So I have any amount of ideas and material here, but I promise you, one of the technicians has lent me a watch and you won't be here forever. I will read this mouse, Mousy, the cat and the cockerel. I guess I better find it here. It's the first time I've ever carried books away from home that weighed more than a few ounces. But I thought I'd be complete. Mousy, the cat and the cockerel. An unwary mouse, so young he scarcely knew where he was, chanced to nap near a mouser's claws. This is what he told his mother of the affair. "I had climbed the hills that bound mouse sanctuary, like some young rat with the world to see, although not exactly where, when all of a sudden two beasts appeared, one the sweetest, kindliest ever reared, while the other run and stop and shake his head. You should have heard the horrid noise he made. With a queer red topknot bare of fur and ragged arms with which he'd make a stir, as if going to fly and he couldn't wait, fluttering his tail tuft at a great rate. Master Mouse was describing a cockerel, scratch earth, as though a bird of American birth, so his mother'd be sure to know it was unique. And then said, his arms went up, and he beat his fluff, bluster, and all he did was so rough, he scared me. I'm brave, thanks be, but he made me squeak and dart. He'd give me such a start. I hated him with all my heart. He hadn't left me any chance to speak to his sweet friend who looked so generous and was velvety like us, tortoiseshell, with long tail, a gentle countenance, an expressive glance, and oh, but his eyes shone. Supposing a rat had grown and grown, he would look like this grandee. His ears were silvery and furred like the ones on you and me, yet I could not address him with someone making a noise like that, so I ran away from it. The mouse said, "My dear, the sweet beast was a cat, a devious, hardened hypocrite." Please notice that I'm not rhyming cat and crit, hypocrite, it's it and it and hypocrite and cat and that and innate and hate. Well, I could not speak. speak to him with someone making a noise like that, so I ran away from him. The mouse said, "My dear, the sweet beast was a cat, a devious, hardened hypocrite, with a kind of malice that is innate. We are animals he would always hate. The beast who had a ferocious air would never hurt us, never touch a hair. Might, when cooked and cold, provide a meal on which we thrive. Whereas a cat would be glad to live on mice alone. So don't, as you would stay alive, take looks for a criterion." Now, thank you. What charms us or not, I think, is the tone, the flavor. And La Fontaine surely holds the attention. In his lines to Monsieur de Barillon, ambassador to the court of St. James, when he begins, "Might fairy tales have some allure for so rare an ambassador as you are? Dear connoisseur, give ear, as I murmur in air, and if I aspire to literature, I'm not too presumptuous, pray concur, to bear." And then, later, on, when he's discussed the war situation, he says to the Duke, "In any case, I'll sing your praise with incense burned for you alone, to whom my thanks go on and on. As for this little fable, just for you from me, why explain? I'm hoping that it may be pleasing to you. Pleasing to you. Even envy ought to see that though you say no praise is due, none praises you sufficiently." Then to Madame de Montespan, when he's asking her to accept the dedication of the fables following Book 6, he says, "To be prized for myself, I could never have dreamed, and but asking the fables be esteemed." And in the same manner, he addresses the opening lines to the Dauphin, the preface of the whole book. He says, "Resonance deeper than mine must sing what it was and is to have been born a king. These verses sketch on unassuming textures the byplay of inconsequential creatures. And if I have failed to give you real delight, my reward must be that I had hoped I might." Translating is a temerary's business. And when a translator says to me, "Here is the book, as the author would have written it if he'd written it in German," I say, "Thank you. I am as indebted to you as if you had brought me a picture, brought me the man's portrait, showing what he would have looked like if his mother had married someone different from his father." John Orzidel, who quotes those in an article on translation, says that Martin Luther summed it up in his epistle on interpretation in 1530. Luther said, "Translation is not for everyone. It requires a truly devout, faithful, diligent, fearful, learned, experienced, and skilled heart." And Mr. Orzidel says, notice that he does not say knowledge or intellect, but heart, and I think we agree with that. Now, I could talk a good long while about the translators' conference, but I shall not. It was Justin O'Brien said, "Who is to translate, or why translate, who is to translate, and how?" Well, those should only translate who love what they're doing and who know the language they are translating, from which and into which they are translating. And then they all agree, and Dryden agrees, that the tone one should try to preserve the tone and the rhythm and never dwell on a word. Hugh Keller says the way to do is to omit what you just can't get in. Well, sounds very original. It's very much more significant, as he, in the context where that occurs. I don't wish to belittle it. Now it's for this sampling of new writers, as the office called it. New is not accurate because some of these are not new and are just newly impressive to me. I would like to read Shark Eggs by Melvin LaFollette. Shark Eggs, a grotesquerie stolen, not from the stars, but from antiquity. Form more dreadful than Mars men or hobgoblins from the moon. A boring corkscrew rocket, no well-paid workman fashion. In your pocket, it will lie limp, somewhat like a sponge mushroom, when ripe and deadly. You feel that you owe the shark an apology for seeing his egg stark naked when out of glassed-in gloom. The rocket takes off in high, then sinks like a clumsy worm. Though you think so, it is not boredom that makes you want to go. Turning with nervous cough to the next tank, you soon feel worse. The steel blue eye of the moray eel is watching you. That's all. Then, it is beautifully rhymed. I should have a neon sign here to illustrate that. Grotesquerie, antiquity, and mushroom, and glassed-in gloom, and clumsy, and so forth. Well, it's well done. Now, Omens of Disaster by James Kirkup. James Kirkup is by no means new, but I have only come on him within the last year. His first book was The Submerged Village. The next, A Correct Compassion. And the present one, A Spring Journey. And this I found in The Listener. Omens of Disaster. There have been all the usual signs, a crack in the ceiling, rust on the bridge, the crossed lines of communication, a bee in the dust. These and all signs no longer matter. We know too well what they portend. We have listened to the cry of wolf too often. We cannot fear the worst. The crack will grow into another gulf, but still we live as if each day were not our last. Then, Tom Scott, and this is written in Scott's dialect, and I'll murder a few of the lines and omit the rest. I te have crossed yon ill-defended border. This is called ideal love, did I say? I te have crossed the ill-defended border that separates the real from the ideal. Yon Chinese lad, Aladdin was, they called him, struck no more magic power from yon old lamp, nor I have doomed, when beauty wrapped her spell over my wild imagination, till it became more real than the real world. The after comes a sickness till me yet, a dream that still can read my soul of both imagination and reality. I'll have no more of it. The guilty dream shall die, and imagination wed reality. He's very accomplished indeed. Peter Russell publishes his books. Sidney Goodsir Smith, you may all know, he also writes in that bewitched lingo, Vox Humana, this is called, and I cannot read it, but the closing words are, this is, I take it, about the crucifixion, or personal crucifixion. I took the dole of man to be my name. I live, I dree, I dee, I live again. Thy debts are weighty, thrall. I fain would have remedy. now. The Tom Scott's ballad, the snows of yesteryear. Just beginning, and her book, her present book, is all the better for that, perhaps, I think. It is called Poems, a Selection. And like the commercials that ring in our ears, I would say, Leonie Adams, Poems, a Selection, is published by Funk and Wagnalls. Well, there is an unsubservient authority about the book that I admire very much. The descriptions are startling. They need their context, but even taken out of it, they are so keen and unstereotyped that they stay in the mind. As where she says, the grape is swung beneath the eyelids of the vine, and then the grapes drop glimmering to the shears. And then the last one in the book and the last lines of it, and thus, when death has taken all the rest, life's self is heard within earth's icy breast. I'm very anxious to see Rolf Humphrey's book, and Louise Bogan's has some remarkable things in it. And then I understand that Wallace Stevens is to read from his next week. And the classic anthology is a real book. Confucius, defined by Confucius. The classic anthology, defined by Confucius, and published by the Harvard Press. And among the lesser complaints, now I close with this. Man ought to sit quiet as bird on bough, cagey as edging a precipice, light foot as treading thin ice. And then another, Cheng, the young king. I think it is amazing, or indeed to me, how much is said in these three lines. Awe is upon me. Thought from heaven pours down. No light fate his who comes young to the crown. That's Cheng, the young king. There's more of it, but that is sufficient. And as the radio people say, I thank you.
Wow. Wow. Da 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 da.
Wow, what a crowd, huh?
Yeah,
they're really eating it up.
Yeah, I guess when you have some point of contact with the general culture like baseball, you can bring them in.
Yeah. I think it's like, you know, I don't participate too much in the culture of poetry in our own time. You know, I don't publish chapbooks. I don't go to many readings. Not that I don't enjoy hearing people read, actually. You know, mm-hmm. We run the talking show here. It is like something I like.
Yeah. In a way, we're heavy participants in contemporary poetry.
Yeah, fair.
We're just only concerned with it as talking.
Yeah.
I think most contemporary readers of poetry have other interests in the
form.
I
guess what I'm saying is I don't participate in the social milieu very much.
Right, you're not that poetic research bureau all the time.
Because there is a scene. Like, people are having conversations. They're blocking out time in their schedule to read. They're blocking out time in their schedule to go to each other's things. Mm-hmm. You know, I go to people's things, but rarely. But on that note, I guess, I must say that it is like, wild to hear an audience respond to a pretty intense verse so rapturously. Like, mm-hmm. Is that just a New York thing? Or is that how everything goes in New York?
My impression of New York is that there's a lot of support for various types of culture in a way that doesn't really exist here in Los Angeles.
So that's what's going on there. That's the support you're talking about.
Yeah, I think so. I think you can get a healthy crowd of serious poetry listeners.
Yeah, well, healthy crowd. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
You could really hear him go for it.
Yeah, it's true.
There was an interesting thing as well where I don't know. I feel like this is another thing that maybe doesn't happen so much now or would just be unimaginable, but that like sort of a high modernist poet would be induced to produce like sponsored content for a major corporation, and that they would also just be like, that's neat.
Well, there's the Song of Styrene, Alain René, and I forget the French poet who wrote it.
Right. Me too.
But that's a similar era.
Yeah.
I guess now, like most things, there's just a whole sector of the economy for that. They're like, you know, creative agencies.
Yeah.
Or whatever they're called. And those people usually went to art school of some sort.
Yeah.
And they're like, you know, I want to make money. I don't want to be poor. And so they got into that. And that really kind of robbed any opportunity that somebody who was doing it just for the cash would have.
Yeah.
Like, people have to identify with their jobs too much now for that to happen.
Right. And you would be like, I am in advertising, as opposed to like, no, I'm a real poet.
Yeah, and the ad guy, the corporate guy, thinking like, you have a unique voice because you're not part of this culture, and I want you to inject that into my...
I mean, we do kind of have that where it's like, you know, whatever, like Kanye West makes shoes or made
right.
in the past, design sneakers.
With that guy, nothing's fully past tense.
But on another note, it's just one of those things where you're like, that's... I guess corporations still do want to borrow the cachet of people, but I feel like not people in the literary context. I guess that's
okay,
the thing.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's like they will take it from pop stars. They will not want the aura of, I can't think, you know, like Joseph Moscone or something like that. Like, no slur on Joseph, just saying, you know, like...
Right.
Like... And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe General Dynamics is calling all the time, being like, we'd love for you to just say something about our new robot dog or something. But I have a feeling that like what most poets would also have to say about the robot dog would be like pretty unflattering to General Dynamics.
It's true. Yeah. We have no choice but to be negative at this point in history.
Interesting. Wild. Hard to think about. I don't know.
But maybe it happens more than we realize. You know, I've met, through sport, I've met a few people who are in the music industry, like, you know, high up in the pop music industry. And, like, they're a bit more, I think, consider themselves experimental, although in the grand scheme of music, I wouldn't say so.
Right.
But then, you know, they'll, like, play guitar on a Beyonce album or something. And so, in a way, she's kind of taking from there.
I definitely know someone who was, like, hired by the sort of, like, pop industrial complex who was an experimental, objectively, you know, has a degree as a lettered composer of weird music.
But to your point, I do think, you know, 50, 60 years ago, these jobs were laying around.
Right.
And artists were like, no, I pay $100 a month for my loft in Tribeca. I don't need that garbage.
Yeah.
And I'm not doing that.
Yeah. But then do.
Well, most yeah. did not.
Yeah.
Hannah Wiener didn't, I don't think.
Right. Well, a different generation, though. I mean,
sure, sure.
Like Wallace Stevens, I don't think ever wrote in praise of insurance, but probably spent several hours a day writing correspondence in praise of the insurance
right.
industry. You know, like
I don't think Robert Ashley did any jingles. He did TV music, right?
He did do jingles early on. Yeah.
Robert Ashley, composer of Here Comes Santa Claus. Right down Santa Claus Lane.
That would be incredible.
I mean, it's kind of it's good talking. It's a bit of a talking opera.
Wow. What a crazy song. Here Comes Santa Claus.
Right down Santa Claus Lane.
I feel like that is
Here
like,
Comes Steve, right down Steve Cato Lane.
I know, right? Right. That's the thing. If you sub in anyone else, it's like immediately terrifying.
Yeah.
You're like, well, why is he coming?
Yeah. Why has he got a lane named after him? And of course he'd use that lane. Why wouldn't he use that lane?
Can we divert him somehow? Is there anything we can do about this situation before Steve gets here and things get out of hand?
Speaking of out of hand, I feel like all this poetry has gotten to our heads.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much,
yeah,
Marianne,
thanks.
For bringing in that tape.
Thank you. Yes, it's great to see you, and I'm glad you caught a little bit of the Dodgers before as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the game got out early, kind of. Things wrapped up earlier than we thought, too, yeah. since those new rules.
That's true. Yeah, we should go have a drink and see what you think about the new rules.
Yeah. Bet you don't like them.
You never know.
I think to some people, the leisurely nature of baseball is its appeal.
Yeah.
Anyway, good night, Chinatown, and good night to our Los Angeles Dodgers.
Here comes Santa Claus. Here comes Santa Claus.
Up to bat next, Santa Claus.
Good morning, Chinatown.